Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. How's it going? It is the 9th of April. It is a beautiful day outside. It is the beginning of a new month, and we are dry for a change, thank God, and we're excited to bring you today's show. April is National Poetry Month, so we have some poets coming on later. My man Tiff is coming on. He has a guest with him. And we have also some other stuff in store for you. I really want to start by saying thank you. A testimony, if you will. Yesterday, and I'll bring Sister Rashi up in a half a second. Now you got your sister. Yesterday, I had the pleasure of doing another Black Wall Street event in Harlem. And, you know, I love going home whenever I can. But this one hit a little differently, and I'll tell you why. The day started off with me running late. That's not uncommon. But as we started on the journey, we, my business partner, now Donnie Glover, shout out to Donnie Glover, the publisher, the owner of BeMoreNews.com. He is definitely a media mogul. He really is. I mean, he has BeMoreNews.com. He has a couple other publications. He's doing some amazing stuff, for real, for real. But anyhow, Donnie and I are riding up the road, and we bumped into a gentleman at the rest stop. So I started up a conversation with the cat because Donnie wasn't there yet. I started up a conversation with the cat about his hat, and he had a Georgia hat on it. You all know I hate Alabama. It is what it is. But we started that conversation. Come to find out, the brother's an author, and he's actually based out of Atlanta. So we get to chopping it up, and he has two books currently, and whatnot. And we were just talking in the car. Donnie and I were just talking in the car about Donnie's upcoming book, which would be his third. And he was on me about writing my first. So you know, it is what it is. But anyhow, we leave that. And from that, we discuss family, the benefits of having a solid foundation and or a good structure around you that helps you get to that next level, whatever that next level is. And we also talked about, in general, teamwork. So we leave him. He's headed to Jersey. We're going to New York City. Easy stuff. We leave him. We fall up into New York. We get to New York. We're on time. We got 15, 20 minutes easy. We get in there. We doing our thing, what have you and whatnot. So we get to the event. There's some discussion about if it's going to be downstairs, upstairs, doesn't matter. We get it settled. We wound up doing it downstairs. Did not know that this month was the National Second Chance Month. And recidivism, I want to say. I want to make sure I'm pronouncing that right. This is the month in which we champion, we push forward the causes of those who are incarcerated, who are returning home. So the event was centered around that, those people doing that type of work. Awesome event. Not only was it a beautiful thing to hear people's stories about how they not only came out of that situation, incarceration, and now really turned their lives over and are really moving forward. But it was a beautiful thing to be in that spot, in that place, to feel the energy in the room. Now, folks had some very moving stories. One of the brothers, he was in solitary confinement for almost the entire time he was incarcerated. No physical touch whatsoever. That is crazy. And he wasn't locked up for a year or two. He was locked up for quite some time. And he is now the chair of the Second Chance Committee for the National Action Network. And, you know, met this cat a couple of years ago. He's been instrumental in the things that we've done in New York ever since. But one of the things I took away from that I really wanted to share this morning, and one of the reasons I labeled the show like I did this morning, was the testimonies from people that they do not look like what they've gone through. And I took that and I said to myself, that is the story of us here in America. We do not look like what we've gone through, most of us. Some of us have allowed the strains, the struggles to really drain us and pull us down. And that is most unfortunate for anybody. They cover it up with alcohol. They cover it up with narcotics. They cover it up with clothes. They cover it up with jewelry. They cover it up with weave or a light-skinned whatever or dark-skinned whatever. Or they cover it up with sex addictions. You name it, they cover it up. Their chase for money, their pursuit of a title, their pursuit of whatever, you know, they cover these things up. And to see people acknowledge their whole self yesterday and the fact that they have not lived that American dream-esque, perfect-esque life, but you see them now doing very well, not only for themselves, but also for the community. You can't beat that. There's a spill that we do, right? No matter who does it, Donnie does it, I do it, doesn't matter. We give the history of Black Wall Street, and we acknowledge that Black Wall Street was just not Tulsa, Oklahoma. So we asked some questions of the audience, and that audience just, we were so engaged. They had answers, the correct answers. We didn't have to pull teeth. They knew what was going on. Oh, man, it was a blessing. Not only that, the purpose of that, the purpose of that whole thing is to shine light on people who usually are in the shadows. These are the people. These are the entrepreneurs. These are the people that support these entrepreneurs who work diligently day in, day out, night in, night out. Yet very rarely are they ever recognized. So the closing recipient came up, and he said that very thing. He said, I'm getting through this, fighting back the tears, because I started my business at the beginning of the pandemic. I had $300 to my name. I took 250 of those dollars to register my business. I took the other $50 to open a business account. And here I am. I've never been recognized for what I did, never looked for recognition for what I've been doing, but I've never been recognized, and I've helped thousands of businesses be successful. So for someone to recognize me and say that they see me means that I'm doing the right thing. Man, what? That right thing? That was it. That was the icing on the cake. You couldn't ask for much more than that. You couldn't have scripted it better than that. Good morning, sister.
Yeah. I'm well, brother. How are you doing this morning?
I'm great. What's going on with you?
That fight is so important, because what you're saying is this is the ultimate battleground of forgiveness for a society. When we say, yeah, you killed one of us. You robbed us. You probably even raped a few of us.
You raped us, right?
Right. You raped us. You robbed us. You killed us. You embezzled us. You know, you did something, or you helped somebody do that something, and we sent you into timeout. And when you were in timeout, you reflected, you rehabilitated. And you did what it was you were supposed to do, so that you could come back out here and join us. And when you do, it is, if we gonna send you, we can't send you. This ain't no insane place where you do one thing wrong and you get sent forever. Forever. How long you in for? Ever.
You know, it's long as I would get the phone off of it.
For our loved ones and hated ones, even, to come home. And
but
if we can't prepare a place, then you actually need to quit sending people to jail, because we don't do it forever. We're going to have to find something beyond jail. If we're not going to find our way into forgiveness after time out, we're going to have to do something other than prison, because it's not fair.
Okay, but do you think that they are not given a life sentence, even if they aren't given a life sentence? What I mean by that is, so I'm hearing yesterday, and, I'll do my research about my state, but my home state of New York has over 1,000 laws on the book that continue to box ex-felons in. So right now, the work is being done for a right to vote bill for those that are incarcerated. Currently, they got legislation passed for those whom have come home or are on parole, but now they want legislation passed for those who are currently serving time. And other states have done the same, so they're pushing for the state of New York to do that. Not only that, but they were talking about other niches within the system that still marginalize those who have served their time and came home, that make it more difficult for them to get educational benefits, to get housing benefits, to get social service benefits throughout the entire
country. I mean, they still give them rules on who they can kick it with. You can't be in a room with other felons. You can't affiliate with other felons. You can't, like, they have to live a life. Hey, do you know it remind me of what they say about the citizenship test, that most citizens cannot
pass the
citizenship test. And in most free Americans cannot live under the constraints of a paroled American.
It was a very eye-opening experience. It really was. And it really filled my heart. I promise you that. Because if you know me, I mean really know me, you understand that I'm not one to waste time. I'm not one to waste time because a couple of reasons. First off, I've always felt that life is short. Then when I lost my youngest brother, it was just reiterated to me how short life is. And, you know, in his death, I made a promise to myself and him that I would live. And living to me means that any moment that I have in which I choose not to sleep, not to eat, or just to lounge, to recoup and catch my breath, I'm moving. I'm doing something. I like to be about it. I don't like to talk about it. I'm not a big talker. Never have been a big talker. I do shit. I don't sit there forever. Oh, what am I doing? Oh, what do you want to do? Oh, what am I going to do? No. It's like, okay, it's 11:16. This is what I'm going to do. And it's done. There's no discussion. What are we talking about? Just do it. Do it. Get it done. I'm listening to these folks who talked about how they had their lives put on pause. You know, now obviously it's from decisions that they made, and they didn't push back that they were unjustly tried. No, they accept the responsibility for their actions. But coming home now, being a part of society now, and being a positive part of society now has shown them how much they've bought, I'm sorry, how far they've come, and shown them that they want to pay back to society for what it has allowed them to do in a positive light. So they're going back grabbing folks who are going through the same struggles as they, and educating them on how to navigate those waters so that they, God willing, the creek don't rise, don't return to the penal system. God willing, creek don't rise, do become positive, sustaining members to society. God willing, the creek don't rise, can prevent somebody else from making the same mistakes that they did. And, dog, I'm telling you, it was 100% lovely. It was a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful event yesterday. Definitely, definitely. Very moving, very impactful, very, very much so. And then I got, you know, okay. I got my dinner from Melba, so, you know, I was happy because that boy got to eat. So I was happy. So what were you saying, Russell?
You a mess. That's what I'm saying. When we attend, this is the old way, like, before television, before radio, and in the era of newspaper and whatnot, when it was really becoming a conduit, not just a rag where people could just say anything, but when honor and respect was interjected into journalism, where the more truthful you could be, the better. Not the more sensational, but the more honest and truthful and actionable your information was, the better it was. Okay, before in that era, if you wanted to get to know something, you had to go to a symposium. You had to go to a talk or some lecture or some gathering where those who either studied the subject or have experienced the subject give their testimony. That's how we did all our anti-slavery abolishment work was word of mouth from slaves and legislators and lawyers chipping away at this thing, at that thing, so that they could understand that this it had to end. It was that big. So when you say I went to this thing, you know, this group, it's not small. First of all, people don't get up out their couch no more. If they can't join it on a Zoom, they like it didn't exist. They got to be able to watch it on their phone while they do some other stuff, you know. Secondly, the connections you made in that room could be lasting. You don't know who's coming, you know, looking for a network or got a nephew who moved in the area and need a job. It never ends because that's the point of the meeting, so that it doesn't end, so that you find these people, that you find these connections with people, and they can help, and you help them. Hey, I'm proud of you, Lee, because most people don't want to talk about folks after you done messed up. You messed up your chance. Get out of here. We don't talk to you. You messed up your chance. You know, get to the back of the line. We don't understand that they're... It was a stacked deck. Like, anytime I get so mad because I'm like, well, why did he sell dope? Well, because he had to feed his family. Well, why was that the only way he had to feed his family? Nobody, you know, would hire him at a wage enough to where he could do it. Well, you know, and you start chipping away at why we kill. And I'm not just saying, I'm not trying to excuse behavior and say that all of it is orchestrated by
that's human behavior. That's not just white behavior. White people kill too. Right, white people kill too.
Okay, I'm just saying that a lot of our it's reactionary behavior, and a lot of the stressors to that reaction have to do with the society we're living in, and so. I'm not saying white folks can drove us crazy enough to kill. I'm just saying that the reasons why we kill and the frequency at which we kill is atypical to that of what we were accustomed to before colonization, before Christianity, before all these other outside forces would come in. We just did not have a history as being warmongering, you know, hurting people. We have figured it out. We have figured out several times how to interject peaceful doctrine into our statehood, not our religious ideology. Peaceful doctrine as part of what it means to be a member, a citizen, or a member of the state. And so, what happens to us, we mimic, you know, we mimic that behavior, and we adopt the customs and cultures of those who are prevailing in the who run the power, who own the power in the system. And in my opinion, Lee, we're not done. It's going to get worse. It's going to get a little worse before we give up on what it means to be Western. And we start digging further into some other ideology. We're going to start becoming those tunic people I love to see in Star Trek movies, where everybody's wearing those lovely gray.
Hopefully, not wearing a red shirt.
As long as you ain't wearing a red shirt.
The red
and the yellows. There's something about that dye and get everybody. But. I look forward to our tunic days. They're coming. Not that we're all going to believe in one religion. We're going to be able to do that separately. But the idea of peace is going to be embedded in statehood, in the way we work our networks of business, and it's going to have to be like written into bylaws and mission statements. If you want federal money, we got to see your peace mission. We got to see your threat assessment is the best way I could explain it. What is it that you do that has a harmful impact on society as a whole? And if it does, if you apple and you know you kill at least 200 little African babies a month digging for coltan, then you got to fix it or else we shut you down. That'll become the way we work the planet. As soon as we get there, we're all it'll be done. We won't need, you understand, to have journalism go down the way it is. We'll all know it's cool because those pockets of people shooting and all that, they won't have access to people the way they do now. But, Lee, there is another symposium coming down in your area, and I'm going to talk to you about it later, and I think you would really, really like it. But I'll discuss it later. I wanted to share my poem. As we know, April is...
Hold that for a second. Hold that for a second. Let the guests get in. They'll be on at 11:30, and then we can all cipher up. I wanted to talk about Justice in Waiting, Ketanji Brown Jackson. This happened in April, not March, which was Women's History Month, but we have the first black female Supreme Court justice about to be seated on the court. Any thoughts on that?
I'm happy. I mean, anytime you get all that time going on where you have something going on where a black woman can't even get her foot in the door, it's some shaky going on. And so to know that at least we have an equal chance at whatever that is they got going on in that dark, sad, dark rooms, at least we got one of ours in there listening. Now, whether or not she's listening on our behalf, whether or not she's willing to behave as if she's listening on our behalf, because that's two different things. You can have our best interests at heart. Have our best interests at heart and not be willing to let others know that. And then there's, hey, whenever you bring legislation that could have a negative effect on this sector of society, you will no longer be able to excuse it by saying, oh, well, you know, we'll fix it later, or they're not here to debate it, so never mind, it must not be affecting them. There will be someone there. You know, because we cannot wait. Sotomayor was not behaving in the best interest, does not behave in our best interest. She behaves in the best interest of the Latin American, and justly so. In fact, I wish she would add to her repertoire Native American issues, because she would be definitely, you know, it would be part of her lineage. But if we got Italian Americans on there, we have an Irish American, we got whatever Clarence Thomas is, we got quite a few. No, I'm sorry.
No, I love it. I absolutely love it. No, that's real. Yo, that's real.
No, but what we do, because they don't say I represent this, but if you've lived as long as they have under those experiences, in that skin, you automatically, you have to beat that out of yourself. You would have to beat the self-interest of those who look like you out of you in order to, you know, to not bring that with you to the judicial seat. So I'm happy. There was quite a bit of discussion about her hair. Like, for some reason, black women, in the absence and presence of whatever's happening with their hair, is so important. But, I mean, I guess I understand, because it's not, you know, a wig, for one. It's not a wig. And quite a few, you know, not to clown Maxine, but it's not a wig, boo. That's her hair. And also, it's not her hair doing European ideology. Though her hair and mine are very similar. But it's at some point you realize that it's just a hairstyle. Like if she's shaving bald tomorrow, she's still Ketanji, you know. I mean, I can't get, I think I got that racist white man syndrome, you know, when you get in power and they don't know how to say your name right. Because I call her, I be calling her Kamala, and it's not Kamala.
Oh, Lord have mercy.
And I be calling the other one Ketanji, and it's not Ketanji. It's not Ketanji. Nobody's saying the end part.
Okay.
It's
so
her,
you got it down pat?
Listen, I just want to see her first. I want
to
see her rule personally.
There
I want to see where she's going to fall. Where's it going?
Because
they already doing some really weird, what they call that, anti-abortion type work going on. And when they bring it in front of her, you know, what is she about to say? Because she gave birth, you know what I'm saying? So what are you about to say to these people who is like, I should be able to kill every baby, any baby? And then she would know about our birth dearth, because, you know, America's getting old, Lee.
Mm.
America,
you tell me I need y'all to make more babies?
Hey, man,
you know,
America's getting so old.
Keep making babies. They get up with these young girls and they make all the, I'm like, I ain't got it in me, dog. I ain't got it in me. I swear, I just don't. I really don't. I'm talking to my son the other day. I told him I wanted to get my granddaughter, right? So the weather's breaking. It's starting to get nice. And I was looking at the weather and I'm like, yo, you know, next week could be a great week. And I'm like, oh, I'll be in New Orleans next week. So that's not going to work. So we were talking, and he wants to go to dinner and so on and so forth. I was like, bet, we can do that. And he was like, well, Dad, you can come get it whenever you want. You know, I'm sure that, you know, we can all use the break. And I was like, yeah, that's what's up. You know what I'm saying? I just wanted her to get a little older before I started taking her out. I wanted the weather to break because I didn't want to bundle up like a damn little snow bunny. You know what I'm saying? And have her all locked in and all that type stuff, and not be able to really enjoy her and the sun and all that. But I wanted to do that. So that's going to come really, really soon. I'm gonna really spend some time with her and all that type stuff. I don't know if I'm gonna have her for the night yet. I don't know if I'm there yet, but I'll at least have her for a good portion of the day. You know what I mean? Like, come get her butt ass early in the morning, just hang out with her all day. And take her back later on. Oh, that depends too on calling COVID, because, you know, those two variants are coming back. City of Philadelphia, the health department just asked for the return of the mask mandate indoor mask mandate, and that was on Wednesday. So, you know, I told my folks, I was like, yo, Philly's 90 miles away. Just be prepared in another 2 weeks that we're going to be masking up again. You know what I'm saying? Because, look, folks, you can't go to Walmart, three different Walmarts, in the same damn day and not mask up. Like, come on, dog. Come on. The chances of 217 ignorant people up in there whom are not vaccinated, whom are sick, they don't care. You know what I'm saying? It's just crazy. So,
and
no, I'm,
and they mean that, you know, they really are trying to either weed out the chaff, like survival of the fittest, some really weird, like, you know, end of days apocalypse. And if I don't die, I can at least clear out those who are too weak to keep pushing. And then there's ones who truly don't believe. They like, y'all are tripping. This ain't nothing but the same flu we always been getting. You know, they don't see it as a novel virus. They see it as some continuation of something we've already had. And so you can't get them to do nothing different than what we've already done.
Mm.
You know, 'cause this is the first time you've ever been asked, really, to go take your ass in the house and sit down and quit coming outside. But, yeah, everything
right.
else, there is no other disease that I know of. Well, they, not the
right.
flu or anything else. They just assumed he was going to sit down with the flu because it was either that or be outside throwing up and boo-booing on yourself.
Speaking of doing things different, you know, Rodney caught a flight for the first time the other day. He went to see his son. That's why he's not on with us today. He went to see his son in New Mexico. And we were talking last night because I wanted to make sure he got in well. And he says, man, we had to fly into Texas and drive from Texas over here to get here. I said, Lord, that must be. Now, that's some, say, Uncle Sugar, that's what we call Uncle Sam. Uncle Sugar will put some crap on your plate for real. Like, and he said, I think he said it's a two-hour drive one way to get from the airport to where his son lives. I think it's 2 hours. Hell, it may even be longer. Like, dog, that is just, that's crazy to me. You to me, that means you're in the middle of bump fuck nowhere. And, you know, you try to get a flight out. Like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, who does that? But, you know, there are reasons and concerns that stuff like that is done. And, you know, I get it because I've lived that life, but Lord, you know, there are times when I really sit back and sit and I'd be like, yo, well, I wish I would have retired. Then there's times like,
it couldn't have been that much more
that
just to drive there. I mean.
Nah, it would have been a hell of a lot longer. A hell of a lot longer. Yeah, it would have been a hell of a lot longer. Absolutely. Absolutely. Because it wasn't just him, it was he and the family. So, yeah, hell of a lot. Yeah, I don't even want to envision that.
This is the son that's single, right?
Yeah, yeah. The one he's trying to get married
up. He's trying to pair up with some unsuspecting victim.
Oh, would you stop it? Would you stop? What is up with you and for some people.
Never mind that. Never mind that. Don't worry.
Mating actually does work. You know what? Hold on. I'm going to bring Tiff up. Because Tiff is one. One of our guests is on. Morning, Tiff. What's going on, bro?
Hold on. I was on mute. What's up, bro? What's up?
I'm good. Would you please let this sister know that mating is a wonderful thing? Tiff has a beautiful wife. He has a beautiful family. He's been married like ever. It is a wonderful thing. Please let the sister know.
I mean, if he convinced her to settle, that is a good thing. You convinced her to settle, I saw you.
She broke him.
That's what
I'm saying. She saw him and she said, you know what? I'm going to break you down.
Convinced her to settle for the work. Listen, I already believe that, one, when women get with men, we usually improve the situation. Either financially or health-wise or aesthetically. Mm. We don't sit there, most women, and definitely black women, and let our men just become, you know, Jabba the Hutt and fester and all, you know, without any purpose, goal, or anything, without personal improvement, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I believe in the black girl magic rubbing off on y'all. So when we do, we settle for who we gonna rub it off on. And that's just how that works.
All right, well, let's rewind this a little bit. Let me introduce my man. So when I got out the Air Force in 98, oh, good Lord, it's been that long. I got out in 98, I came home, and I was already writing. I've been a writer forever and whatnot. So I started bouncing around on the scene here in Baltimore, and Tiff was doing his thing. And I'm like, yo, this brother is skilled, like really, really, really skilled. So throughout the years,
thank you.
We've bumped into one another. We've blessed the same stage. We've blessed the same mic. I have since fallen to the black, but Tiff is still doing his thing. I saw him at the Biggie Brunch, held at Darker Than Blue.
Yeah.
Shout out to Casey.
Oh, man, Casey.
Doing his thing.
Casey.
Right, right, right. And as soon as I walked in, I was like, yo, next month, Poetry Month, I got to get you on. He was like, bruh, no problem. I got you. He said, matter of fact, I want to bring somebody with me. I said, come on, man. You know me. The more the better. It's all love. So we're waiting still for his. Oh, I don't know why. I don't know why. You gave him the same number that I gave you?
Yeah, I'm going to try.
That's the number to call.
Give him a
number. Okay. No problem, no problem. But, yeah, so he's coming up shortly.
Thank you for the big up.
Oh, no problem. No, look, man, you deserve it. You deserve it. You know what I'm saying? But, yeah, the brother is hot. He's definitely fired. Definitely wanted to have him come through. It was just appropriate and fitting. I what better person to grab? You know what I'm saying? I mean, there's other cats, but, I mean, when you can get this, like, okay, you good. So, what's up, man? How you doing? Say what's up to Sister Rashi.
Oh, I'm doing great. And like you said prior, I've been on the poetry scene since the mid-90s, and I went back in the office for like 10 years, and I made a lot of money on poetry, and I made a lot more money in the office, but I wasn't satisfied. I wasn't reaching anybody, you know. I helped build Obamacare. I don't know how many people that helped, but I know poetry helps people. And that's what I love to do, and that's what I'm getting back to.
Yeah, that's what's up. That's what's up. That's definitely what's up, man. I mean, I again, the show is aptly titled Testimony and Cypher because of stuff like that. You know, I have been in the room where people have been moved to tears. They've jumped up and clapped mightily. You know, you touch people's spirit. You know what I'm saying? When you talk, when you speak your truth, even if it's the truth of others that you've spun into a story, you know what I'm saying? And it reaches somebody and touches them like that, there's no better feeling in my head than that. You know, I often get it.
Exactly. There's no better feeling than going anywhere in this country or even in this world, or to Canada or South America or London, and somebody like, hey, I know you. Tiff Poetology.
Right.
And then they might say, like, I met my wife at your venue, or even people are like doing plays, writing books, making movies, even going to politics, you know, from things that they hear at a poetry venue. They're like, okay, you know, some stuff got to change. So I'm running for city council. I'm running for mayor. You know, my wife's running for mayor. And you know, that influence is like amazing.
When did you start writing?
You know, the funniest thing, when I got my very first job out of college, I was working for the mayor's office of in Philadelphia. And the secretary, she's like, I know you. You're the kid that used to write for Johnny Carson. I was like, oh, my God, I forgot. At 5 years old, there was a writer's strike across the country, I don't know, the National Writers Association or whatever. They went on strike. And I decided at 5 years old, because I stay up late and watch Johnny Carson, and I wrote jokes to Johnny Carson, and I sent it to him.
Really?
And what he said was, he didn't read my jokes. He said, I can't read your jokes because of, you know, whatever the politics was. He said, but this kid from Philadelphia sent me these jokes, and they were funny. And he sent me a letter back. So I guess I started writing around 5 years old.
Oh, that's cool, bro.
Wow.
That's cool.
Wow.
That's cool. So when did you get serious about it?
Excuse me? I didn't hear that.
I mean, he was serious enough to send it to Johnny Carson, so it was
Johnny Carson at five, so I guess he was serious at that point, right?
Hey, but when did you really start holding on your craft?
Well, I've always been a writer per se, but I never wrote poetry until I was in college, and there was a can't remember the sister's name. We had to read her. It was for a class, and it was like she's looking for a good brother. And it was saying all the positive things in a brother and everything like that. So I'm gonna write a response to that. I'm looking for a good sister. And that was in 1993, and I wrote that poem, and everybody loved it. And I was like, that was just off the cuff, So then I start writing again, and I started getting a lot more attention. But I never actually performed poetry until I got to Baltimore.
Really? So we broke your cherry?
Yep.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's wild. So where was the first spot? Where was the first spot? Hold on, Bryce. I got to know this. Where was the first spot? The spot on Lexington Street or Pigtown?
No, I was actually down on, Coward Street, I believe. What happened was I moved to Baltimore because I was apprehensive. I had some problems home, and I got back into the street. I started doing some things I should have been doing. Let me get out of this thing. One day a brother came up to me, right, and it was a crackhead, and he said, you're the stupidest MF out here. And I'm like, I'm ready to beat this crackhead up. Like, why you call me, He's like, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, you out here on the corner with me. And I was like, ooh. Mm. He's like, Mr. Penn State, you out here on the corner with me. I went back to my house and I just packed my bags and I went to Penn State, Because I tried to go to a black school. I couldn't afford it. I went to University of Maryland Eastern Shore, and I couldn't afford it. Mm-hmm. So I went back home, and I got back to the game. But Penn State needed black students, so they gave me a full ride. So I went to Penn State, got educated there. But so anyway, to make a long story short, I was in Baltimore, and I was like, okay, I'm not going to be going out on corners. I'm not going to go to no clubs, nothing like that. I'm going to keep it straight. So I seen that Larry Stewart. You remember that?
Yes, I do. That was the next spot I was going to say, Larry Stewart,
I played ball with Larry Stewart. I played for Solomon Grass with his brother, Leonard Stewart. And they were ball players from my hood. So I'm like, let me go down there. I was like, poetry night. I went down the first night. I'm like, wow.
Ronnie Norman.
Yep. And I went down there three times, and finally it was Olu and Bossy Hoax and a dude named Butt Naked.
I remember Butt Naked.
And Olu was like, are you going to do some poetry? And I was like, I don't do poetry. I'm listening to y'all. I'm enjoying myself. Have a couple of Heinekens. And then one day I was like, okay. I read that I'm looking for a good sister poem, and I seen the reactions from the crowd, and I kept going from there.
Go ahead, Rashi.
What's the drive for it? Are you a romanticist? Are you a Langston Hughesian? Or are you there for revolution? Are you coming with, the Gwendolyn Brooks, the Sonia Sanchez flair? What is the underlying current that drives most of your inspired work? Is it situational, or are you there trying to do, or is your work trying to do something?
It's situational. Like I'm not an erotic poet because I'm not a sexy dude. I don't talk
but
like
you're
sex.
Six foot tall,
sex.
Dude. That's all you need to be.
I don't write erotica, right? But it's situational. Like my cousin died 2-3 weeks ago, and I went and sat on the toilet to cry. I got a text from my brother, and my cousin died. My favorite cousin, and he was a writer too. He wrote 3 books. He wrote a book about me. I'll tell you about that later. Anyway, I'm sitting on the toilet, and a poem just came out. And I my toilet is next to my office, and I just grabbed a piece of paper off the printer and a pen, and I wrote a poem, and And I sent this to some folks, man, and they loved it. And I read it at his for his eulogy. So it was situational. You know, like I said, the first poem I wrote was, you know, in response to the sister, I can't remember her name, I got to look it up. They wrote, I'm looking for a good brother. So I wrote, I'm looking for a good sister. And sometimes I write poems, I write the funniest poems. You know, I write, you know, like I try to be a comedian, it didn't work. like when Biggie died on March 9th, I wrote a poem called March 9th that like everybody, you know, knows, you know, about the day that hip hop died. I said, hip hop died on March 9th. You know, so it's pretty much situational.
Nice. Very nice. Now, you said you went to school at Penn State. Did you get creative writing? Was it part of your curricula? Did you choose any type of writing classes other than the ones we all, you know, English 1 and 2, the ones we all have to take?
Well, actually, I didn't take any creative writing classes. I mean, I had English 101s or whatever, 100s or whatever. But I was an African-American studies major. So, of course, in there we had it, you know, we had the Sonya, some Langston, you know, Langston. I'm about to say Slangston because Slangston is one of the best poets here in Baltimore. But Langston Hughes. So I read a lot of poetry through there, but I have two degrees. I have one in African-American studies. The other one is in speech communication, rhetoric, and semantics.
He's just showing off.
You know,
He's just showing off.
I
got two degrees.
I'm struggling.
He's actually a degree poet. He's scientifically poetic.
rhetoric and semantics is like teaching how to be a speech writer. You know, for a company or a politician or anything like that. So, you know, how to reach people and how to word it. And then the African-American studies gave me the background. So those two things really helped, you know, combine. They came together to make me, you know, that's what type of poetry I do. You know, most of my poems, like, you know, even the one about my cousin dying, is like, you know, there's a line in there, like, you know, it's genocide. We're killing ourselves. You know, why are we killing ourselves over, you know? I mean, yeah, it's so that's what drives me. Whatever's going on in the world, I can write a poem right now about the what's going on. I live right across the street from Mercy Hospital, and the new Baltimore police station is right there, and they're going to move the block away. They're going to move all the strippers away. There's justification.
Come on,
going
you think they're really
going
to do that?
I think so. I mean, you want to put some money together on it, man?
You know what?
You're down displacement of strippers?
I've seen it coming up, and I'm gonna say this, and then we have actually a caller in. We have to have a very nice board. We had somebody call in, and they've shared the show with a number of people. I thank you all for listening. If this is your first time, this is Real Radio. That stands for Radio Established to Address Life. Your co-host is Rashi. Your host is me. My name is Lee. We do this every morning from 11 a.m. until 1 p.m. We have a political tilt, but as you can hear, we talk about everything. This is National Poetry Month, so I brought my man Tiff on. Tiff is a very skilled poet. We'll get to that in a heartbeat, get him to spit some stuff for us. I'm trying to find his guest. I have not found that person yet, but hopefully that person will get it sooner rather than later.
I'm retired, so I really want him to spit, and I really want to know about him. And we talked about erotica. He has the best erotic, the sweet spot. His name is Angus Burroughs, and he's traveled all around, like, he's like 25 different cities in this country and in Toronto. And he does a spot. He's coming to Baltimore in June, and he you got to see the promo on how him and his wife brought this concept up. So that's why I wasn't
angel. If he's going back to Toronto, no problem. If he's going back to Toronto, I got to hook him up with Dwayne Morgan so they can link.
Dwayne Morgan gave me my favorite, I would say, when we got Toronto, our name was up in lights. Like,
I'm,
you know,
telling
like,
you,
Dwayne
is the man, dog. Dwayne is the man.
We got hotels. We got everything.
And
our name.
All you gotta do is say his name. Dwayne, I'm here with Dwayne.
Oh,
Dwayne Morgan.
On Broadway, it was like Tisseline, Salam Hayfi, Lamar Hill, and lights outside. We had to do the three shows there. But Dwayne Morgan is the damn man.
I want to bring our caller in. Good morning, Ashton. How are you? You had a question or comment?
Hey, good morning. Good morning, man. How are you? I just want to say thank you first to Pastor Don Jr., CEO. He brought me on to your station, so it's my first time, and I'm glad to be here. The Elite 300 winning team members, thank you. My situation is I was a gold medalist, was past tense. I was a gold medal swimmer in the Special Olympics, and it is real life. They do not pay their athletes 100%. I'm sure you guys are familiar with NCAA rules and different things like that. The Special Olympics is similar. In fact, we get no scholarships. We get no stipends. We get no nothing. You can Google me under Ashton Smith Special Olympics. I was a black female swimmer in their organization for over 30 years. I don't know if y'all are familiar with the Special Olympics or not. I do not know. I just know my story. With their program, it left me homeless, broke, and bankrupt, which is real life, right? And at the end of the day, I gave my all. I gave my life to a program that did not dedicate its time or their lives to me. It's unacceptable in the United States to go without, and that's why I'm glad that I have people that are able and surrounding me to try to help uplift me out of poverty and teach me the right way. You can only feed yourself the information that you are taught, and if you're taught wrong information, that's what you know. And if you're around people that are going to put you in good positions, then learn that, because the Special Olympics, they do not pay their people, and it's unacceptable to put your life, your hard work, 10 hours a day, 7 days a week for a program. That's a job. 10 hours a day is a job, guys. 7 days a week, that's a job, to get nothing, and you end up with medals that are worth nothing. But your time, you can't get that back, and I don't care what business you run. Time is money, and if you're not making no money, it ain't making no sense, all right? So at the end of the day, I'm a woman that keeps it real, and I tell you the truth, and I'll give you a Texas handshake because that's where I'm from. At the end of the day, I tell people the truth so that they know that they have the right to live, function, and grow. You have the right to grow financially. Not just physically. You have the right to grow financially in your marriage or any of that in your life. You shouldn't be left here destitute, broke, or living off of people, or living in poverty, or living on the streets like I was. I have a book called Swimming Upstream to Realize the Dream. You folks can catch that at Walmart and Amazon and where books may be sold. At the end of the day, I know that that book is a story of my life. And it's the story that I give to people so they can tangibly hold it in their hand.
Amen. I don't want to cut you off, but that's definitely an opportunity for us to refocus a show specifically to what you're talking about. And if you don't mind, I did Google you, so I have some information, and I will take your information off air, so that we can reach out to you later and we'll discuss about how we can put something together to specifically address your issue. Today we were more focused on Poetry Month, and
Amen.
We wanted to keep the conversation moving in that direction. But again, I thank you for listening. I thank you for your story.
Amen.
And again, I will talk to you off air and get some information from you, and we'll work around that, okay?
Thank you, man. Yeah, it is Poetry Month, and that's why I brought up my book. I'm not a poet, but I write books, so I thought maybe that was more appropriate because you're talking about books and things. So,
love y'all. No problem.
That's testimony.
Thank you. You should. God bless y'all.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Definitely
testimony. I appreciate that.
In relation to what you were saying, I know that we do a at Penn State, we do a Special Olympic event. for every Special Olympics tryouts are there because I have two autistic stepsons. But my other things that you were saying about payment, that's one thing I brought to poetry and one thing that why Baltimore loves me. I tell a poet, like, every time you open your mouth, you should get paid. Because you are giving out a product. Your words, your wisdom is worth money. And when everybody saw that you can make money off doing poetry, they were like, wow, how is he doing that, you know? Whether it be, you know, through books, CDs, the cover charts that shows, you are an artist. All artists should be paid for their art, and athletes as well. I'm not going to get into the big thing with college athletes getting paid or Special Olympics people getting paid, but that's one thing I brought to poetry, and that's one thing that people love me for. Like, man, how are you living off poetry?
That's a real living off of poetry. One of my favorites, brother, is Amiri Baraka. I love Amiri because it was he was music, he was blues, he was angry, he was funny, he was he was unapologetic, and you.
I don't want to cut you off, but. You see the picture on my Facebook page. I mean, I was there the first time he recited that 9/11 poem. Who did it?
Who knew of America?
I was there.
Who?
Yeah,
oh my
yes,
God.
I was there the very, very first time he did that
healed,
in New York City.
Brother.
I was right there, and I took a picture with him, hugged him, and being like, bro, you are the man.
Just who? Yeah. Who? You know, and coupling it with the jazz. Coupling it with, with political, because if you listen to him, you could know stuff that you never studied before and get an open opinion that'll let you move on to something more academic. I really appreciate those who don't try to cram an entire lesson, but they give you just enough seeds of information that you can then take that and grow into the future. What do you have, like, as you know, musicians have their groupies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Culinary artists.
That's a married man.
That's
a married man.
No, you don't know. You don't know what happens when he gets through talking at the end. Do they? He's married. He's not dead. You understand? So what I'm asking is, when you have used your voice and had your way with an audience, do you have to deal sometimes with the consequences of your poetry? Either some person misinterprets it and comes and say, "When you said that part about black women, I didn't agree," or even someone will say, "I feel like you were talking just to me,"
Just to me.
I saw you looking in my eyes. For 15 rows back, I know you were talking to me. There are consequences. Do you often have to deal with consequences of your work?
Well, not me per se, because usually, like when most of my poetry career, I always had a woman by my side, right? So that and she made sure that didn't happen. But I managed over like 20 poets. And, oh, my God, the groupies. Ooh, Lord. Especially if we out of town. I don't know if I should be saying this, but when we go out of town, let's say we go to Chicago and they put us up in a nice hotel. We do a show, man, there's going to be when we come back to the room. they will be there. But the one effect, like I said, I've never had the groupie effect. The one effect I had one time, I said a poem and I said something about Farrakhan. And one day I was sitting with my daughter's mother, and my daughter's a baby, and three members of the Nation of Islam came over to my table, like We're all great friends right now. But they came over to my table like, brother, what did you say about what you say about the minister? And I was like, well, what I said was, well, I can't even remember what the poem was, you know. But I said something.
See, what happened
something
was, what I said.
And that's what you say. I said what I said, okay?
So I said, okay, brothers, why don't we come back to my place and we discuss this? And they came back to my place, and I'm not going to say anything, you know. I'm just paper in my place because I know what's in my place. Me and three nations of Islam, brother. And we talk. Brother, I can tell you two of the names, brother. Edipo, MC, and Akil Mazan, two of my best friends right now. We hashed it out. You know, I was like, you know, this is about praying on Farrakhan, this is Islam, because I am Muslim. And so we hashed it out, and we've been doing, you know, I seen Akil Thursday, you know, we laugh and clown, have, you know, good times and stuff, you know. But so that's the effect
that I have.
Sure. I don't have a groupie effect. That's not me. My phone really bring up.
Tim, I want to ask you.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, please, Rashi, go ahead, and then I'll get my question.
I have a local friend. She's a poet. I've been trying to get her on, but she's bigwig now. It's kind of hard. She has a poem called Treat Me Like a White Man. And every time she does it, there's almost silence. Not the applause that, or the snaps, I guess, that y'all are accustomed to, depending on how enlightened your group
hate
is.
Those snaps.
You hate snap people. Don't say, you know, come
them.
On now. Don't be hating.
I don't like snap stuff either, man. I'm sorry.
You need to understand something. The poetry scene went from something, it's like hip hop. It went from something pure and really artistic to this commercialized bullshit because of Love Jones. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
We didn't snap.
Yeah.
When it was pure, we didn't snap.
Yeah.
We either applauded.
No, the snap predates Love Jones, brother. The snap is from the, like, the 40s or 50s. It was when.
I don't care.
My man Reggie Gibson, he wrote that poetry for Love Jones. I'm the blues in your left eye, the funk in your right. He didn't get paid shit for that, man. And he got one scene in Lorenz Tate walks over and goes, "What's up, Reg?" That's it. They didn't give him no credit for that, nothing. And I'm like, yo, that's not gonna happen to my poets. My poets gonna get paid for their art, man. You know, that's gonna happen.
That's crazy.
Holy,
that's crazy.
Crap.
But anyhow,
but that was like the basis
of
the material.
Right. Let's continue the thought process. Though. When it was pure, we didn't freaking snap. We clapped. We applauded. We gave people their flowers. All this, you can keep that shit. That is so amateur-esque. That is just the people that just heard about poetry yesterday and just went to a set. Hold on, Rashi. Let me finish. Just went to a set. No, I did. I hated, absolutely hated it. Plus, the venues that catered to people like that, most of them, what they were receiving was trash. Most of that crap is trash. It's built and designed totally to get those snaps from the audience. It's not built actually develop anything good. No good work. No awesome work came out of shit like that. You know what I'm saying? Most of those cats that got up were fly-by-nighters I'm a poet, and they get up and they speak, and you're like, you a clown. You a clown that can rhyme. Poetry is not all about rhyming. Every line does not have to rhyme. You know what I'm saying? You're not a rapper, dog. You are a poet. You're supposed to give people something to make them think, to take them to a different plane, not just, you know, I don't remember the brother's name. Heavyset brother, in every poem he ever talked about was about fucking. Every one. It was about sex, every last one of them. But he was a clown. It was so good because he was so funny.
Can I curse you? We called them pussy poets.
Okay, yeah. The poem wasn't good. His delivery was good because he was a clown. He was just so freaking. He was three quarter drunk almost every time he hit the mic, and he was
three quarter.
He was the Bismarck three quarter drunk. He was the Bismarcky of poetry. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, he was the Bismarcky of poetry. He was a clown.
Lee.
He was just a freaking clown. Yes.
Lee, there's only one unacceptable crowd response. Are you ready?
What's that?
Take your time, baby. Take your time. That's my baby. Take your time, baby.
We ain't got time for that. You got to spit and get off.
When you tell black people that they can get a job doing poetry, that's comedy to them because black people are labor manufacturers. We do her. We produce something. If you don't have a thing that you have made or something you have reshaped or manufactured, we collectively don't like to call it work. We call that a hobby or we call it some kind of special talent. And what you're trying to do is get it in our minds that this is not just art. It's work. It is a person's daily mission. It is something that, just like you got up and you went and saved a life by doing heart surgery, that person later on got almost the same healing power or something comparable when they sat down and had their favorite poetry read to them or were able to create their favorite poetry in a serene, peaceful place. What you're trying to tell us is to stop putting poetry up on some high shelf that you pull down for the month of April or when you're trying to get some pussy or something like that. You pull down poetry when you're trying to do the work, society's work, the work of the people, because we won't always receive that. We won't always receive that in a military speech. But we almost always are willing to hear a beautiful poem, whether you back it with music or not. We are ready to receive poetry. And so, but we're not always ready to give it.
But to that point about doing the work, Tiff, you know, as I was saying earlier, you know, I think being a poet, well, that's not true. For me, being a poet has been very good for my mental health because it allows me to express myself in a manner that I don't think a lot of people see that side of me. And when I am in that mold, because, you know, dog, look, I get those I get those moments when I'm just right. I mean, I can bang them out in no time. One after another, there's like and then for me, it's nothing. And I don't think it's right. It's just that I just don't have the appetite in that moment. You know what I'm saying? Where other moments, I'm just hungry. I'm starving. I'm like, yo, I got to do this. I got to do that. Like, yeah, this just came to my head, and I want to put this out there.
You talk writer's block, right? I used to mess with this chick named Writer's Block. She was hot, but she didn't understand what my tongue was for. So I said, listen here, woman. I need a woman I can adore, like sexually, ass, civilly, all that alliteration and this metaphor. I don't need you no more. She tried to come back. I couldn't feed from her. I didn't need from her. I automatically peed on her.
Come on now. Come on now, yeah.
See, you trying to start something.
The power.
Okay, I got you.
Hey, do you understand how much power it is to wield the mouth? I mean, you can do more with the mouth than the sword, the gun, and even cash. Even cold hard cash pales in comparison to what you can do.
You said the mouth. I'm the strongest person against ever putting hands on a woman. But you can hurt a woman so much more with words. And I have that problem because I have that silver tongue. And I'm like, damn, why did I say that? You know, and I might say something to my daughter, and she recalls it like years later. You said to me, I'm like, oh, yeah, damn, why did I say that? You know,
well, you know, it goes in line with the saying, you know, people may forget how you said it, what you said, or what you did, but they always remember how they felt. You know what I'm saying? So, the tongue is mightier than the sword. You know what I'm saying?
And so, when you know how to use it, it's a superpower. And like drummer's brain, able to use both feet, both hands, and possibly even sing, right? The drummer's brain. Mm-hmm. When you have an oratory brain and you didn't build it the old-fashioned way by reading, you had to get it by listening to how people are listening to society. Like you say, the situational work of society. But at some point, sir, you have to put out work specific to an idea. Like people, when you do a book of poetry, it's about family, or like you say, it's a pussy poem book or whatever. But when you get ready to put your works out, usually they have to collect under a theme. Most publishers and editors ask you to hone it in, rein it in, and make it make some sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you have been able to do that, what is your editorial work? How do you edit yourself? How do you pull yourself back?
I actually never, ever, ever, for the first time ever in my life on Thursday, I told a poet, he had said a line in his poetry. I was like, you should have preceded it with this line. And that's the first time I ever did that. When I publish poetry books for poets, I never alter, ever. I mean, if it's you know, incorrect grammar or misspellings, okay. But I'm not, that's your thoughts. I can't change your thoughts.
Mm. No, it's the editorial eye is not about changing the theme or changing it's about sharpening the knife so that it cuts better. It's about, you know.
But then that's not that person, though. To this point, that's not that person. So, you know, what you felt in that moment is what you write or you recite. If I come back and say, like he just said, you know, you should have done this and you should have said that. No, because that's not what I was feeling or thinking in that moment. So you are changing my thoughts in that for my moment. You know what I'm saying? And that's not
cool. To her perspective, like when we're like I used to have a studio like on 910 State Paul Street, Poetology Studios. We made like about 30, 50 CDs in there. And we put together an album, and we're like, okay, it's too many pussy poems on this album, dog. You got to give us some political something.
Yeah,
you know,
something
do that.
Right.
You know, do that. Like,
right.
You know, like, drop this one off and put this one on, and, you know, and just, you know, throw a live one on, some music, you know, with a beat behind it, some music. You know, we got to mix this up. You know, it can't be all this, you know, and it can't be all a cappella, you know, we do that, you know, I do that, as, you know, as promoter, producer, but I'm not going to change the word.
I'm hurt because I never got an invite to do a cut on any of the albums or the CDs, so I'm a little hurt by that, but I'm pretty sure that the next go around, I will get some consideration. I appreciate that. Wow.
Yeah.
I missed a whole lot. No, man.
I had moved up to New York, and Talal Macy and Lamar Hill stayed at. They kept the studio going here, and that's why I was working with Def Jam Poetry, which was a big hiccup, because what Russell tried to do is he treated poetry like it was hip hop, and they're two different genres, and they're similar. But they're two different genres. The way he tried to do Def Poetry Jam like he did Def Comedy Jam, and you know the way he was picking the poets and the way he was, it was just a big hiccup, tell you that much. You know, but I worked recruiting the poets and stuff like that, and even like we had a poet, Jamal St. John, was one of my favorite poets, and he never aired because his applause was way more than everybody else's applause. So he got edited out of the show. And he got people standing up and screaming. So you couldn't have him, and then you have somebody else come up, and everybody just looking at the stage, like, you know, that was good. Crap, snap, snap. So, you know, snapping, you know.
Right. I don't want to keep you forever. So what did you see? Do you see a viable future for poetry? I mean, the slams have really tapered off. I don't think they're as prevalent as they used to be. I think it's going more back to underground like it used to be, which is good. You know, I don't see as many poetry nights anymore. You know, do you think a resurgence of that happened?
I think, like, I used to have 5 poetry shows going on a week. Like, I had my own spot, then I had, like, you know, I owned Gallery 409 down on 12th Street, and then like, we had 5 spots going on at one time. And I do see a resurgence because I see the new poets out here. You got Archie the Messenger. Mm-hmm. You got Black Chakra, Spanks and Hughes. Oh my! And I went to All Sisters because it's Women's Month too. So I went to All Sisters Poetry Slam about a week ago, and they were fire. So all these guys they learn from like the poets that I work with. So the next generation of poets are so. They're getting better and better. As in hip-hop was like, and I still, you know, by Ken and Keith, you know, KRS, they still, you know, Biggie and Pac, I still love them. I really don't respect anybody out here right now. But poetry's getting better. These poets are getting, I'm like, oh, I'm scared of these kids, man.
Because some hip-hop is now poetry between Tank and the Bangas, Chica, No Name, and even some would say Anderson .Paak. These are poets.
Yeah, I can see that. But yeah, I do see a resurgence of poetry. COVID, you know, had influence on everything. NPS, but even in Baltimore poets are the best poets. Like the best poets used to come out of Newark, New Jersey, and New York City. Now the best poets are coming out of Baltimore because all the poets from Newark, even Ames, he said, can he get a slot on your show because he could call in. So I'll text you about that.
Oh, yeah.
The best poets are coming out of Baltimore because like, a lot of New York poets came down and tutored them, and they learned from them. And they are, these poets down here are dangerous. And like the Baltimore Youth Poetry Slam team won like the national championship 2 years in a row.
Yep.
These are the poets that we read.
Yep.
Baltimore people, they see Baltimore coming and slam, they're like, oh, shit. You know, that's the way it is now. I mean, you know, see, we are the truth in poetry here in Baltimore, man. And I do see a resurgence, whereas a lot more venues are picking up poetry shows again. And like she said, a lot of new artists are poets, and I can see it. And that's why I want to get back into it 100% because I know what it can do, and I am a money man. I know how much money can be made. So.
Right. So, your children, have any of them picked up the pen and the paper?
My daughter, she featured down in Who's the Soul last month, and but she plays nine instruments and she sings, and she does poetry. She's been featuring around D.C., Montgomery County, Virginia, Philly. She's 23. Naida Celine. She is dope. Dope. Now, I don't say she's dope because she's my daughter. Because, like, you know, I got a young he wanted to be a rapper. And I was like, nah, dog. You know, and I'm like, that's not for
you. That ain't your life. That's not your life. You ain't got enough
bars. He said no bars.
You know, he had a track, get it popping. And I'm like, no, nah, man, no, nah, it's not popping. He went out to L.A., and now he's a millionaire. He's a writer. He writes for the South Park. He's an associate producer for Bob's Burgers, and he's about to do the South Park
another one of the COVID movies.
Yeah.
Oh, they're gonna do another movie. They're doing another movie.
Yeah. He's a writer. He's a writer on that. He's killing it out there. We made from Poetry Hour until we made two movies together. They didn't do well, but the last one, Kevin Hart was in it. He did a cameo for me because he's from my hood. But so we made movies and stuff and everything like that. So I'm like I was saying, my daughter is the truth. And it's just hard. I can't manage her because I'm her dad.
Right.
It doesn't work. Well.
I think you're so. I can hear the humbleness in your voice from not wanting to correct others when you think they could write better, from not wanting to have too much influence over your daughter's work as to rest as her father and not want to double down as a father manager. These kind of ideas of not wanting to have control, this is an artist idea, to sit back and being able to see it but not take charge of it, right? And it's going to keep you living long, brother. Let me let you know, that's the key, to see it and even know what it'll take to do it but not feel compelled to be the one all the time. All the time. It's not from you. That's the power of life. Well, did you have a piece other than that one you dropped on It's So Hot? You know, you dropped it so hot and fast. You slid it in on us like that. And
he
I don't like when
he
just slid
retired.
In on me like that. I hate when they slide it in. What I would like,
ain't
though,
like
is to hear a piece. No. Go ahead on and drop it hot. Don't slide it in quiet like that. Can we get a piece from you? Can we get a piece from you today?
I'm retired.
You was just on the toilet coming out of retirement. So it's not real. It's not real. Retirement for the enlightened mind is not real. So, and in that, there has to be a piece pre-retirement that you feel comfortable sharing. Come on, for us, brother.
I will try to come up with something, but what I want to say is that's how I got into poetry promotion and pushing poetry. Like when I got up there on stage and I saw him, brothers and sisters, I'm like, oh my God, they are fire. That's what gave me more drive to push poetry and step into the background and push poetry forward. Because I'm like, okay, I think I'm good, I'm great, but these people are, when you respect the art like that, like, wow, this person right here, so that's what, and I've never been a great speaker or performer, so I don't know. But you guys really want something? I don't know. what do you want?
I absolutely do, because, see, first I wouldn't have begged if you hadn't teased, but more importantly, what you're telling me is you have done the research. You have familiarized yourself with the Black struggle in your college work, and you have also been responsible for that message in your everyday work with your writings and help with what you do cinematically. Now, you have work that you yourself have written that you might not have sold or shared. And so I think it's an excellent opportunity for you to share something of yourself
if you are feeling comfortable enough to. And this is a safe space. There'll be nobody calling in talking about, get that whack shit off the air. There'll be no call.
All right. So, try to keep this short, but it's about 3-4 minutes long. I'm going to give you my resume so I can just tell you exactly who I am. How's that?
There you go.
I'll take it.
All right, my resume. My objective is to attain wealth, maintain my health, achieve the highest level of knowledge of self while maintaining myself, achieve the potential of self while being myself. So I say to myself, self, who am I and why? And why is it so hard obtaining wealth, maintaining my health, all the while being myself? And myself says to me, self, just be yourself. My education, 1972, 1990, school of the hard knocks. The streets of Philadelphia, make sure you don't kill yourself. Major, survival. Degree, denial. 1995, Penn State University, I know you heard of me, 40,000 plus, but that was none of us. Cultural shock. Major, political studies, liberal studies, journalist studies, communication studies, or basically whatever I could studies. Degree, background of the, you must be very artful to use this degree, arts. With smarts in African-American studies, don't expect any money because actually you ain't from or never been to Africa and you ain't guaranteed all your rights as an American. So forget all you can while you're attempting to claim African and or American. In the meantime, you're being played by the man. Work experience, 1972-1995, working on my mom's nerves. 1985-1992, hustler, player, convict, too. Misguided youth part-time, half-conscious black man full-time. Duties included but not limited to the following. Gambler, scrambler, coke dealer, gun dealer, genocide killer, money pillar, and the girl at the end of the block. Yeah, that was me that was filling her. 1992, 1995, bust my ass to survive and stay alive, learning, schooling, showing the non-believers I ain't fooling around. I ain't the same clown that stayed locked down, robbing all the sweet dicks around town, penitentiary or hell with down, but best to leave, tip is still down. 1995 to the present, you wouldn't believe how far I went. Pseudo member of the establishment. Dudes including but not limited to the following. Ass kisser, nine butt kicker, no more malt liquor, finger off the trigger, pockets are thicker, opportunities are bigger, exemplary figure, but yet and still I know I'm still considered a nigger. Awards and activities. I'm a full volunteer, young black man in a society that hates me, baits me, degrades me, blames me, and whose fate we can all see through all the disparity, but then again, maybe just me. Awarded. Over 25 years of life, and that's no height, a purple heart for all that got lost in the fight and still considering the fight, and neglect all factors white. Member, Strong Black Man Club. Member, I walked the Muscle Million Club. Member, I ain't never going to give back my black club. Member, praise God above and profess my love club. Awarded, a baby girl. Life, L-I-F-E, eternity, my destiny, bringing out the best in me. Fate, F-A-T-E, eternally through paternity, I will be the best that I can be. You will see the me that my mama sees, see that my drama's relieved, see the me that God sees, see the me that my daughter needs, see the me that God sees, see the me that beyond me, see that me, that's who I be. It's all in me. Accomplishment, peace, P-E-A-C. Maybe temporary sporadic, nonetheless, peace, peace of mind, peace of soul, peace of what I know. And with every little bit of my baby girl's glow, grimly reaping my soul, I remember the words my grandma told. First come God, then come you. Even that you meant me, I'm going to maintain that philosophy, and you will be, we, and we will all be a society and search, always the search for that place called free. For mankind, above and beyond all the nonsense, and living by the true meaning of my name, common sense. For the Lord, myself, my family, I'm going to be who I am through all adversity. Whether learn through the street or the university, I'm going to be to the best of my ability with the ability, me. Outstanding black man, that's what I'll be. And my references are available upon request.
I'm me. Hey. Okay. Well, Lee.
Yeah.
That was a treat. That was a treat. So often
you had something you wanted to share?
Oh, Lee.
Yes, you.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't write poetry for sharing, but I do have a particular poem that like last week, a particular poem I've chosen to share this week. This week I have Claude McKay. Claude McKay, my favorite. One of my favorite Claude was because he, at the time when he wrote this poem, he had just got real pissed off. You know what I'm saying? And so often we want to convey a message to the masses where we persuade them to do something or we try to get them to remember. Not often do we want to get them to act or incite. So when Claude McKay wrote If We Must Die in the end of 1919, what he was trying to do was incite us to think about not just how we are dying, and by the way, we're kind of still dying very similarly to that, instead of not so many nooses, but still dying at public spectacle. When he wrote it, he wanted us to stop being so damn scary and get angry enough to make change. So he wrote in the poem, If We Must Die, if we must die, let it not be like hogs hunted and penned in an inglorious spot while round us bark the mad and hungry dogs making their mock at our accursed lot. If we must die, oh, let us nobly die, that our precious blood may not be shed in vain. Then even the monsters we defy shall be constrained to honor us, though dead. O kinsmen, we must meet the common foe. Though far outnumbered, let us show us brave, and for their thousand blows deal one death blow. What though before us lies the open grave? Like men, we'll face the murderous, cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying, but fighting back. It is one of my favorites. It both uplifted us and let us know that, one, it's okay to be angry, and second, we know who we get angry at. It's not a game. We can stop pretending we mad at classism. We mad at actual people. And I just loved the poem, especially when you think about the era at which he wrote it. And I don't hear many poems that angry. Hip-hop, yeah, but not poetry, just angry at calling on us to do something about it, instead of muse about it, you know?
Hold on. I'll come in, and Tiff, I'll let you go after this, after we get your information and all that jazz. If love was blind and stupid were a person, yes, that would be me. As a two-time loser, I'm not one who's in the position of giving advice. However, if I'm asked, I'll speak on it. For those who can't do, tend to teach. So let me tell you about me. First of all, I'm no saint by any means, but two, I'm not even the greatest of pickers. I've loved women who have loved me, but I guess I was too greedy. No, I've not been just running around after some draws. I want to be with someone who wants and needs me, someone not so jaded by their past that they're giving up any hopes for a future. Let's learn and earn together. Let us agree to agree, not barring disagreements, but understanding that they are a natural part of the process of us becoming one. So let's not allow those pebbles to become boulders, preventing us from growing closer. Let us speak in terms of we, so that the world can know that together we have found a great thing.
You guys go deep. Y'all be going into the next layer with y'all's work.
That's what it's supposed to do.
Yes.
That's what it's supposed to do. Supposed to touch that soul.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, dig into.
Supposed to touch you. Supposed to touch you. Well, look, Seth, give your information. You're still managing. Let people know how they can get in touch with you if they want to. They know somebody that needs some help and guidance as you publish those books and all that type of jazz. And, you know, how can the folks reach you?
Well, I'm Tiff, T-I-F, Saleem, S-A-L-E-E-M, everywhere. Gmail, Facebook, LinkedIn, everywhere. I'm Tiff Saleem everywhere. I'm the only one. But anything, like you said, he wants to get with you next week or whenever you can book him during the Poetry Month. But the sweet spot is coming to Baltimore Sunday, June 19th at Baltimore Sound Stage. So Sunday, June 19th, it's going to be a hell of a show. It's in New York on May 29th. And they're doing it on May 14th in Atlanta. But, yeah, Baltimore is going to be, June 19th? I'll send you the promo so you can see how it really goes down. He takes poetry to a whole nother level. So you talk about the resurgence of poetry. Poetry, is going further and further than it has ever been before. You know, we want to move up a book to see movies. These shows are bigger than Slam and everything. So
that's what's up.
Check it out.
That's something. Thank you for your time, brother.
Pleasure.
Appreciate you.
A pleasure for you guys having me
Always
on.
A pleasure.
And need
Always
some,
a pleasure.
Some people for I got some politicians to talk to you, man. What's going on here in Baltimore?
Look,
but,
I'll take whatever you got. We'll talk later. You be good, all right?
All right, man. Thanks, man. Peace.
All right, man. Peace. There's some breaking news as we've been on the show. Unfortunately, we've had a death. Dwayne Haskins, young man, just got drafted into the NFL about 3 years ago. He passed away this weekend. He was hit by a car. He was the Washington football team drafted him originally to be their starting quarterback. Things didn't work out. He has since moved on to the Pittsburgh Steelers. And again, he lost his life this weekend. Wanted to send the condolences to his family and all those whom supported him throughout his career. Again, going back to how we started the show, man, life is short. You know, you can live it. You can think about it. You can talk about it. You can be about it. So I tend to be about it. You know what I mean? Next week, I'll be in New Orleans. So we're going on the road next week. The week after, you know, be back here, I think. I don't think I'm going anywhere the week after. And we'll do it like that. The world, and I've been saying this for a while, the world is preparing for war, family. Let's be hopeful that it doesn't go that way. But I saw a report this morning about China ramping up its nuclear weapon capabilities for fear that they're going to have to go to war with the U.S. Obviously, Russia is not proven to be the formidable foe that any of us thought. But they still have nuclear weapons, so we'll see what happens there, especially with the Ukraine situation still being hot and heavy. But the Ukrainians are still defending themselves and holding it down very well. I want to talk about sports for a second, and I had a whole write-up that I did on Facebook, but I'm going to go from the heart with this. I kept my mouth shut pretty much about the NCAA tournament. Because this was the last year for my coach, the only person I know to captain Duke University's men's basketball program. He was retiring this year. And I was very hopeful to send him out with the championship ring, and that did not happen. We lost in the final four round to our nemesis. I can't even say their name. Oof. You know what, Carolina, I'll say that. I'll leave it at that, who subsequently lost to the actual national champions, that's the Kansas Jayhawks. I was quiet for a number of reasons. I was quiet for the most part because it was working. The more I talked, the less we won. So I shut up and we started winning more. You know, men, you know, sports fans are very superstitious characters. So that was one of the ploys that I used. The other reason I was quiet, again, is because I'm 47 years old. I'll be 48 this year. Coach K had been the coach at Duke University for 41, 42 years. That's pretty much the entirety of my life. That's a huge change for me personally. And as a fanatic of that team, it's a huge change to the team. John Shire will take over. John Shire was a former player, former captain. I have confidence in Shire's abilities, but it will never be the same. And I had to reconcile that within myself, that at some point, and God only knew when that point was going to happen, the dance was going to be over. Again, it ended one game earlier than I thought, but it was going to be over at some point. I am grateful for the years that I enjoyed being a spectator for the Duke's men's basketball program. I will continue to be a fanatic for that program. We just got a verbal commit yesterday from another five-star recruit. We have 5 5-star recruits in this class. I am very excited for next year, but that's next year. This year, I still have to reconcile the fact that the last time I saw Coach K coach, we lost. We lost in the ACC tournament in New York City, in Barclays Center in Brooklyn. And I was determined to be there because I needed to see him one more time, to be honest with you. And you know, the way it turned out was the way it turned out. That's okay. It has taken a lot and a lot number of years for me to get to a point like this, because in my youth, I would have been sulking still. I wouldn't have wanted to talk about this still. If I would have been in disbelief, hurt, a whole lot of emotions going. But I'm no longer a child. I'm a grown-ass man now. So it's a different way that I approach things like this, and I hope that spills over into the rest of my life. I really do, because it's healing. Coach K has been an ambassador for the sport of basketball in general. He's been an ambassador for college basketball specifically. He was one of the last people to hop on the bandwagons of the one and dones. This is why we had such non-producing seasons. That's a good way of saying we lost for a good number of years, because he didn't agree with it. But once he embraced it, the world changed. You know what I'm saying? But yeah, he stuck to his guns for a while, and I agree with him. I don't think that any person is ready to accept that type of responsibility after 1 year in college. I think you should at least do 2 years. The first year, all the hype. I mean, live through the hype, learn how to maneuver and deal with the hype, and then the second year, really hone your craft, and then move on. So that when you do move to the next level, the hype doesn't overwhelm you, the money doesn't overwhelm you, and you're more prepared for it all the way around, physically, mentally, and your game. But that's not the way it is. You know, it's like a prison, the pipeline. It's a high school, it's a college, it's an NBA line right now. And a lot of these kids that are coming out, they don't do anything. You know, the vast majority of them are still going to the D League. They're in the D League for 2 years, 3 years, whatever, and then they actually make it to the league. What's the difference in playing in the D League and playing in college? You know what I'm saying? I've never understood that at all. But they make their choices. But again, Coach K won several gold medals with the USA men's basketball team, not only at the Olympics, but international games, so on and so forth. It is truly an honor. It has been an honor to watch him on the sideline, and I'm appreciative of his family for lending him to us week in and week out. I'm appreciative to the brotherhood for standing up and together to push, work as hard as they could to win as much as they can while he was there. Again, this thing ended in a way that I didn't want, but it's over. And we will move on to next season. Speaking of which, we're about two, three weeks from the NFL draft. So the NFL season is knocking on our doors as well. Major League Baseball is starting pretty much in a day or two. Most teams will have their opening day by the 11th. A couple teams will have open day afterwards because obviously some teams have to be on the road. But pretty much by next Friday, everybody should have an open day at home. I'm looking forward to some Major League Baseball. I love Major League Baseball. I think it's a great time to bond with your neighbors, to be honest with you. The tickets are cheap. It's an outdoor sport. It's fun. It's a whole lot of fun. But that's neither here nor there. For all of those who joined us today, for Tiff coming on, Rashi, thank you for sharing the piece that you found. For the callers that called in, thank you all again. Again, we do this every Saturday from 11 a.m. until 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I don't know where you are, but it's 11 to 1 Eastern Standard Time. So if you're down south, it's 10 to 12. If you're on the left coast, it's 8 to 11. If you're in the Midwest, it's 10 to 12. We thank you. We appreciate you. Sister, you have anything to say before we get out of here?
Just that this is a poetry month. It's also Autism Awareness Month. It's also, you know, you really want to pay attention to getting as much awareness as possible. Also, buy a book. Hey, you know, buy a book this month. Find somewhere. Buy from a thrift store if you have to. Buy a book. In fact, get into buying a book a month at least one a month. Don't just buy it, read it. And begin to transfer your information out of the hands of the television into the hands of, in your own hands. You know, you get to process it the way you want to process it, not the way someone has processed it for you. Other than that, you do some good poetry in. If you can't read it, listen to it. And once you're done, try to write it. Try to get your own poetry out there, because what it is one person's opinion, you know, about how life should be. And we all have those. And so you should be willing and able to express that. Other than that, Lee, thank you so much once again. I'm going to actually head out to the thrift store. I'm going to go find.
I'm about to get my feet done.
Find me something to wear to work on Monday, yeah, and just try to get out. It's 50-something degrees here in Kansas City, and so it's time for us to come back outside. It's spring, and I'm going to go and find me some clothes that some big girl then decided she don't want to wear no more.
Look, y'all, make sure y'all keep your hands to yourself. Don't be like Will Smith and get banned for 10 years. In other words, you all be good. You all be safe. We love you, and a damn thing you can do about it. See you next week. Peace!